Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM.
Program complete. Enter when ready.
The curtain of night is drawn back. The telescopes are trained. The domes are open. The audience is set. Now, step into the event horizon.
4, 3.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Event Horizon radio program here on Astronomy.fm radio. That means it is another Friday night, and this one happens to be August the 18th, 2017. Universal time, that would put it at 1 o'clock in the morning, August the 19th, 2017, Saturday morning. So that means this part of the broadcast is live, and if it happens to be your time right now and you're listening to us live, don't forget, come on over to the chat room where all the cool kids are hanging out.
Yes, and good evening, everybody. It's me, Nicky Vets. And Marty, what do we do on Friday night? We do what we do every Friday night. Well, at least when we're live. We take over the world!
Oh, okay.
Well, we do, actually. Think about it.
Oh, I guess so. Around the world in 60 minutes.
Yeah. But hey, still, we're taking over the world. We are broadcast all around the world, except where... they don't want people to get new ideas, unfortunately. Well, say who? Oops.
Yep. Say hi to everybody in our chat room. We've got you and me so far. We've got Glenn, Starstorm, Cassie, and Black Projects. Glad to have you here. Of course, we always invite every listener to come on over to the chat room at astronomy.fm/chat or go to the homepage and join in. If you've got questions for us, just type in the chat room. We'll answer them as best we can. Or somebody in chat room will also try to answer for you.
And of course, if you are listening to the rebroadcast, go yes. to the AFM website. Mm-hmm. Now, Marty, you and Diane should be doing this. You should be promoting the website for the links. Go to the AFM website, look for the Event Horizon for this date,
mm-hmm.
and there you will find the links from the show. We try to do this. We do this every time we're live.
Yes,
I'm ably assisted by Starstorm, my great Lynx collector.
Hello.
Hello, Starstorm.
And of course, the greatest thing is about being live. As Marty says, we can answer your questions. Bring your question in. There's no such thing as a stupid question, but we'll just tell you if we can give you an answer and if there is an answer.
That's right. And hi, Twist Edge also.
Hi Twist, nice to see you.
Yeah, we have our homepage, official not homepage, we have our official Facebook page. We have our unofficial Facebook page, which I haven't posted in 6 months or so. We also have a Space Pirate Facebook page too. That's where you'll find the Space Pirate links too.
Yes, and the thing is, everybody, do come to the AF to the pages we have on Facebook. The more traffic we get, the more we know. And please leave comments. Now, I am on the official... How about comments about comments?
Leave comments, yes.
As I say, I do actually check the Facebook pages on a regular basis, particularly the official AFM page. I do go by and check the Under British Skies page. No, Comet Watch... Yeah, we do have a page, actually, but it's kind of a specialist group, so you need to be a comet person and to join us, unfortunately, but we do have the Space Pirates page, and Dale and myself maintain that one between us.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
what do we want to talk about this week?
Well, let's get the sun out of the way, Marty.
I think we should do that too, yes, because we're going to be talking a lot about the sun.
Flare.
And a humongous sunspot on the sun right now. Active region 2671. Sunspot group that's not quite to the central meridian of the sun, but a couple more days it will be centralized. It is a group of mostly smaller spots, Earthside spots, and smaller, but there's a lot of them, and they're spread out pretty wide, actually wider than the planet Jupiter. So my estimate as the spot group is at least 100 to 125,000 miles across. So if you get a chance, this whole next week, get a chance, get out there and look at the sunspot group. They're getting rare and few and far between because we're definitely getting in towards solar minimum now, but this spot's going to be the best one for at least a few weeks. Now, there's another one, if it survived, going around the far side, might still be there, might not be, but so far this is like the sunspot group. Has, like Nick says, it has been flaring. So if you have a hydrogen alpha telescope, you want to look in there and see if you see these little bright regions that sort of come and go out of it. Yeah, you can actually watch it flare. You can watch the spikes of the flare actually change within just several minutes of watching it. So it's a good one, and if it's flaring right now, it's going to be sending stuff towards us. That means there's a good chance for some auroral activity in another few more days.
Actually, it's already aurora season in Iceland. My good friend Black Project showed me a picture earlier this evening that was taken, I believe, the night before.
Okay.
So for high latitudes, for auroral activity, minor 30%, severe 45%. Middle latitudes, minor 10%, severe 1%. Predicted KP max is currently 4. There's a 10% chance of an M-class flare and about a 1% chance of an X-class flare.
Right.
And, of course, the thing is, the moon is actually a waning crescent, so it's a very good time to go out looking for aurora.
Yes, indeed. Solar wind speeds are at 508 kilometers per second. That's kind of medium high. Particle density is medium low at 3.99 protons per cubic centimeter. So that's enough to give a little bit of extra charge to our atmosphere around the polar regions there.
Now, see, the thing is, what we have to remember is everybody going, oh, it's solar minimum. Our star is a G3 dwarf. It's also a variable star, which means that it can change as and when it decides, really.
Mm-hmm.
So just because officially it is solar minimum doesn't mean that nothing's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
We've been seeing an awful lot of solar activity recently, a lot more spots than expected for this time of the cycle. So it could be that the sun is going perhaps in a variable phase. It's a little more active than expected, which is good. But as I say, don't
for
get...
For observers,
yeah. And for aurora enthusiasts and ham radio operators as well. Sorry, lads, I had to get that one in. But no, but seriously, thinking about it, a variable star doesn't stay the same. And a lot of people really do get hooked into this thing about solar minimum and maximum. It is a variable thing. The cycle isn't just the irregular solar cycle. There's another cycle on top of that as well. So don't get fooled by being told it's solar minimum. With a variable star, that can be misleading.
Mm-hmm. Oops, I might have pushed the wrong button on chat. I'm gonna have to go backwards here. No wait, I'm still in
you're
chat.
You're still in there. You're still in there, Martin.
Okay. Oh, I lost my Soho. That's why. Okay.
You lost your Soho.
I lost my.
Not touching that.
I see the auroral map. What did I go on to? Spaceweatherlive.com. I never heard of that website before.
That's what I posted into chat, yeah.
Oh, is that what you posted in there?
Yeah, okay. I posted it in there, yeah.
Oh, you did. Okay. I'll save that one. Black Project was reposting that was not produced by the big spot, but the one behind the limb. Yeah,
There was a C4
the flare?
A flare that was on the other side of the sun.
Ah, okay. Or is that the limb now?
We are getting some effects from it already.
Okay.
Now, this is what I mean about being confused by solar maximum and solar minimum.
Mm-hmm.
Just because the solar cycle that we've accepted says that it's actually the sun is dropping into a minimal phase, it isn't. Everybody thinks we are a standard G3 dwarf Yellow Dwarf. We are not. And this is what people need to get used to get their heads around it. Mm-hmm. It is not your bog standard G3 Dwarf, Yellow Dwarf. It is a variable. It is just like some of the other stars, like Myra. Perhaps not as variable as Myra. Mm-hmm. However, it does change. And just because current wisdom is saying, oh, we're now in a minimum cycle, you just really have to forget about that and just go and learn about that great ball of hydrogen that actually keeps us all alive and ticking over.
Mm-hmm.
What can I say? If you want a minimum, you would be looking at the Maunder minimum, where the Thames froze. It froze so thick, they could actually go out onto the ice and roast an ox on it without risk of it going through into the river. Ooh. And at a particular point of the Thames' history, the river was basically a sewer.
Ah.
Yes.
They don't want you roast ox getting in,
no, you
in
don't.
Sewer water.
But the ice was that thick, you could roast an ox properly without risk of it. Yeah, they had frost fairs on the Thames at that particular time. It Probably. Was so bad that most people saw it as perhaps a mini ice age. And that's another thing which perhaps is a misconception. The Earth is, yes, there is climate change. I'm sorry, I have to say there is. Some of it is natural. Some mm-hmm. of it is man-made. Have we accelerated global warming and change? Yes. We've been burning fossil fuels since the start of the Industrial Revolution. So, yes, it is going to help push up the temperature on the planet. Mm-hmm. Everybody's weather is going to change. The Gulf Stream, which comes across to the British Isles, comes up the North Atlantic and crosses, gives certain parts of the UK almost tropical weather. You can grow palm trees in Scotland, believe it or not, because of the Gulf Stream. Mm-hmm. You can grow them in the Scilly Isles because of the Gulf Stream. So that is just purely a warm, a very warm current of water that changes the actual climate where it comes ashore. Mm-hmm. So, as I say, there is global warming. We have contributed to it. We do need to look at how we can actually reduce our contribution to it, carbon footprint, as they call it. But sticking your head in the sand and saying, oh, no, we're nothing to do with it. We're not guilty. That's a fallacy. We have added to it. And I'll be honest, the planet goes through phases of heat and cold, and we're just... We're lucky enough to be in an interglacial period.
Yep. The warm region, the naturally warm region.
Well, yeah, as Black Projects, a couple of 100 years later, the Carrington effect happened. And whilst Marty's talking about SOHO, I will go look up the Carrington effect.
Okay. Looking at the extreme ultraviolet images, the one that's at 304, they color red. It tends to be kind of close to a H alpha view, but a little bit off, but does look like they're, at least in this ultraviolet image, looks like a really huge prominence in the northwest region of the sun. I could see that little bit of flaring on the very left edge. There's a coronal hole in the northern part of the sun right now, so we've got some pretty good solar activity, and that's what I was hoping for the eclipse, to have some decent solar activity that we can see during totality, and looks like it's okay. Now, the big group right in the middle of the sun, that'll be good for focusing your cameras and your telescope on, stuff like that. If you have a hydrogen alpha telescope, it gives you something nice to look at while the moon's slipping across the front of it there. So kind of nice to see a sun going across a sunspot. That's all the only filter you have, or an active region. The moon slowly covers it up. That's nice, too. So there's a little bit of extra something to do during the partial phases because it's generally kind of boring. Hopefully there'll be some good stuff on the sun. I'm predicting it looks so far like the eastern side of the sun, with north up, it would be the left side of the sun. Looks like we're going to have some decent activity along that edge for the solar eclipse. And of course, we're going to get talking about the solar eclipse in a little bit. So right now, the sun is just doing its own thing right now. Looking pretty good. And by looking at the SOHO images, especially the LASCO images, where they basically they got a screen in front of the sun itself, they can see the outer corona. That'll give you a general idea what the shape of the corona will be during the eclipse too. So go to the SOHO website and look at the LASCO 2, and I think the other one is the LASCO 3 images. That'll give you a general idea of what the coronal shape will approximately look like. That's the outer atmosphere of the sun, by the way.
Okay, now, the Carrington effect. This was the solar storm of 1859. It's also known as the Carrington effect. It was a powerful geomagnetic storm during solar cycle 10. That was 1855 to 1867. A solar coronal mass ejection hit the Earth's magnetosphere, and it induced one of the largest magnetic storms on record. That was September the 1st and 2nd, 1859. The white light flare in the photosphere was observed and recorded by British astronomers Richard C. Carrington and Richard Hodgkinson. Now, studies show that if a solar storm of this magnitude occurred today, it would cause more widespread problems for a modern and technologically dependent society. What happened was in 1859, it kind of disrupted the Victorian internet. As Backlogic points out in the chat room, that was the telegraph system. Now, it supercharged the telegraph cables, and an aurora was visible all over the planet. Now, I did say that, all over the planet. So what happened was, many sunspots appeared on the sun from August the 28th to September 2nd, 1859. Southern auroras were observed as far north as Queensland, Australia, and just before noon on September the 1st, Richard Carrington and Richard Hodgkinson independently made the first observations of the flare. They compiled independent reports which were published side by side in the monthly notice of the Royal Astronomical Society and exhibited their drawings of the event at the November 1859 meeting of RAS. So what would happen today would be the fact that most of our power infrastructure will probably collapse. And It was thought to be a Y-class flare. Thank you, BP, for that. So just think about this. You have got power cables. You have transformers. There is perhaps the only thing that could be done to save those transformers during a flare of that magnitude, actually creating magnetic currents not only in the cables but in the ground, would be to shut down the power grid.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually worked out the actual transformers that are affected. These are the big ones you see caged off here in the US.
They're like school buses standing on end. They're that big.
Yes, exactly. These things, they make 1.5 of these things a year.
And so there's thousands of them out there right now.
Thousands of them out there and all across the planet. So basically, let's put it this way. If there was a Carrington effect and it was a full-on hit, unless someone shuts the grid down straight away, and you can imagine the political repercussions of doing that, it would be a very, very brave person that turns around and shuts the power grid down in New York City or Washington, D.C.
Oh, I think they'll have no problem doing that.
Oh, I'm sure they wouldn't, but the actual fallout would be heavy, considering the fact, technically, we're now back in the Stone Age. Unless, of course, you've got solar power at home.
Well, we were that way, you know, quite a few years ago when that big power outage across the whole Northeast United States went out.
That was due to a power surge. Uh-huh. Niagara, I think it was Niagara B. The actual piece of equipment, this was actually talked about in the very first episode of Connections by James Burke. Hi, Optronics. Nice to see you here, mate. Now, what happened was there was an overload in the system, and the system shunted it onto power lines. And there's a little device that sits on these lines, sensing not only the voltage, but I believe the current. When it reaches a certain level, it trips. It cuts out. The idea, yeah, it triggers, and the idea is to protect the rest of the system. Mm-hmm. Well, what actually happens is that you get a cascade across the entire network. So the power is now being shunted elsewhere. And all these little triggers are literally literally activating and shutting people down. It shut down most of the East Coast.
Mm-hmm. I think what it is like, well, if you shut off one section, the other sections have to take over, and that overloads it, and then that shuts down a section, then another. The rest of the sections have to take over. The rest of the sections have to take over as they cascade down, and it just overwhelms each section, so they just kind of shut themselves all down. But you save all the equipment that way.
Exactly.
So then it's just a matter of going through the procedure of firing them back up, making the connections, and back in order so that they don't overwhelm themselves when you try to start them back up again. Don't want a power surge up. You don't want a power surge down.
And, of course, the other thing is places like New York City, they get all their power in from elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they were trying to pull in power from other areas, and there just was no power. So in the end, there was just utter chaos.
Mm-hmm.
People were trapped on the underground, the subway over here in the US. I beg your pardon. They were traffic jams. People having operations suddenly had to go to flashlights. And you couldn't light a candle in modern operating theatre because the gases used for anesthesia are expensive. No, they're expensive. They're explosive.
Explosive, as you say. Mm-hmm.
They are also on the expensive side.
They're also on the expensive side. But, of course, the other thing is, it really showed us just how little we've journeyed from the caves of our ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
Looting broke out in a lot of places. The police were overwhelmed. They had to use the military to restore law and order. Most people, when they suddenly have their power ripped away, become animals.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's everybody for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Sort of.
And how many...
some people.
Well, yeah, but how many people here could put their hands up and say, I could survive 3-4 days, maybe longer, without food, rather without power? Or maybe can they say, well, I could survive 1 month, 6 months. How many can do that? Nobody. Very few people can do that today.
Mm-hmm.
We are dependent on supermarkets, we're dependent on the mom and pop stores, they're called over here in the States.
Yep.
To keep us fed.
On the refrigerators, because we don't have mostly dried food. We don't have preserved food that much. So,
exactly.
Yep. The water, if the power goes out to the water station, the water pump motors, you have no water. And that's one of the worst things to have to go out.
As first. I say, you can't just go out and dig a well anymore.
No.
A lot of people in New York State and in neighboring areas suddenly find out that their cost. They thought, a perfectly good water supply. It was contaminated. Their groundwater was contaminated.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that. I think that happened to Michigan as well, didn't it?
Yeah, a lot of wells in Michigan are contaminated from farm runoff and stuff like that too, and industrial factories and farm runoff. It's actually polluted groundwater. So, yeah, sometimes if you even have a well, it's not even safe to use. A lot of cities that were kind of used to be on the borderline between the city and the countryside, that they had wells and were forced to convert over to city water. So it's actually illegal in a lot of suburban cities to have a well if you're connected to a city water system. So you have no backup.
Hey, it's also illegal in some places to actually collect water in barrels for your garden.
Exactly. Don't know why that is, but
I know why that is, because certain companies have decided that water is not a basic free right anymore. You
mm-hmm.
have to pay for it. I won't go any further than that. I'm sure you can all guess which company I'm talking about.
Uh-huh.
But anyway.
Yep. So, anyways.
Back to 1859, this aurora was visible as far away from the poles as sub-Saharan Africa, so Senegal, Mauritania, perhaps Monrovia, Liberia, Monterrey, and Tampico in Mexico, Cuba, Hawaii, even areas closer to the equator such as Colombia were able to see this. Telegraph system in Europe and North America failed. In some cases, telegraph operators were given electric shocks, pylons threw sparks, but some operators could actually send and receive messages because they disconnected their power supplies.
Mm-hmm.
All the power was in the cable. In fact, there was one report in the Baltimore American and Commercial Advertiser that says, those who happened to be out late on Thursday night had the opportunity of witnessing another magnificent display of the auroral lights. The phenomenon was so similar to the display on Sunday night, though, at times the light, if possible, was more brilliant and the prismatic hues more varied and gorgeous. The light appeared to cover the whole firmament, apparently like a luminous cloud, although which the stars of the through which the stars of the higher magnitude indistinctly shone. It was the light was so greater than the moon at full, but had an indescribable softness and delicacy that seemed to envelop everything upon which it rested. And between 11 and 1 o'clock, when the display was at its full brilliancy, the quiet streets of the city resting under the strange light presented a beautiful as well as singular appearance. That was the, as I say, that was Baltimore, USA.
So that was the 1859 event?
That was the 1859 event, yeah.
Okay. Now, to explain why, what happens is that, yeah, when you get a lot of, the atmosphere gets electrically charged, it obviously likes to be attracted to stuff like metal. And the biggest stretches of metal, and it doesn't charge it a whole lot, just a little bit, but the more metal you have, the more the charge builds up. So basically, a charge was building up in the biggest strings of metal out there, and that was the telegraph lines. I don't know what voltage they worked at, but let's just say they worked at 100 volts. Okay, well, the electrical charge across the lines from the sun made them like 6,000 volts. It's kind of like your telephone line. Yeah, like your telephone line, the modern landline, they work off about 60 volts. And if you charge them up to 6,000 volts, none of the equipment that's attached to it is going to survive. So we've got power lines. They're only supposed to go at a certain rating. They get overcharged. They start burning stuff out. We have telephone lines. We have cable television lines. You know, they've got, you know, sheathing and stuff that's metal in there. So all that stuff would get charged up, and whatever's attached to it would get zapped. When you get to high voltage to it, you can't. It tends to jump short connections, so that so even though a switch might be shut off, the power could actually jump the switch and short something else out too. Well, it could be pretty bad.
As Black Project points out in the chat room, we had a near miss in 2012, and a similar sized flare went off, but the Earth was actually out of position, so Mars got hammered. Several of the probes and rovers went into safety mode, which is probably the best thing to do. Mm-hmm. Just tell them to wait X period of time and then wake up. Mm-hmm. Because we can pretty much figure out how long it's going to be before it's safe to actually operate again. Yeah. Now, Cassie's saying we just lost sound.
Really? Or Cassie just lost sounds. Anybody else?
Anybody else, have you lost sound? Please let us know in the chat room.
Let me type it into our chat room.
Glenn says he's okay here, still on from Twisted.
So okay,
we're still connected to Canada, and we're still connected to Georgia.
Okay, good. Then it's just one person that sometimes happens, yeah, too.
So anyway, the interesting thing is that there's other evidence. Now, ice cores containing thin nitrate layers have been have been analyzed to reconstruct a past history of past solar storms, predating reliable observations. So it's claimed that some of the data from the Greenland ice cores show evidence of individual solar flare proton events, including the Carrington event. Now, much more recent work by the ice core community shows that nitrate spikes are not the result of solar energetic particle events, and indeed, no consistency is found in the cores from Iceland and Greenland. And they could actually now be due to terrestrial events such as burnings. So the use of this technique is in doubt. And of course, less severe storms have occurred in 1921 and 1960, where there was widespread radio disruption reported. The March 1989 geomagnetic storm locked out power across huge sections of Quebec. And of course, on the one we're talking about for 2012 was July 23rd. And so that a Carrington-class solar superstorm, which is a solar flare, a coronal mass ejection, and solar EMP, and it was observed its trajectory net missed the Earth in orbit. Information about those observations are available on the NASA Goddard site.
Okie dokie.
So it's all there. The information is there. And it's always good to know. Of course, the thing is, for me, that means all my radio gear has to be disconnected, and that does mean everything. That means the power lines, the lot.
Antennas. Long antennas. Yep.
Well, yeah, I prefer to use long wire antennas instead of beams, but you'd certainly want to be disconnected for one of these events. And of course, I keep a spare radio inside a metal box. It's called a Faraday shield.
Mm-hmm. About halfway through our program, so let's do a little station identification. You are listening to the Event Horizon program here on Astronomy.fm Radio. It is a Friday evening, and this one happens to be August the 18th, 2017, about 9:30 in the evening for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America. So universal time, that would put it at 1:30 in the morning, August the 19th, 2017, Saturday morning. Now, don't forget, we got more programming coming up after the Event Horizon, so stick around. It's going to be, I think, all the Eclipse-heavy programming, so you might want to listen
and
to that.
And Comet Watch.
Comet Watch, too. And we'll repeat all these programs every 4 hours for the next 24 hours. So in case you missed part of it, you can always catch up later and get the rest of it. Let's see. How about something semi-related to it? Is the moon's magnetic field was discovered to have, through studying of rocks brought back by Apollo 15, discovered to have lasted longer than previously thought. Previously thought that the moon's magnetic field lasted about a billion years. And then it tapered off, and originally thought they just thought it maybe solidified and tapered down to nothing. No, turns out that, the moon's magnetic field, though in a weaker state, actually lasted for an additional 1 billion years. So technically, the moon had a magnetic field for about 2 billion years. First billion years stronger, second billion years tapered off considerably, but still stuck around for another.
We have questions in chat, Marty.
I've got
to interrupt you. First off, the latest one was from Optronics. There's steel rods inside a reinforced concrete out of the Faraday shield. Not quite. It has to be a actual complete metal container. There was one from Glenn earlier in the show. Sorry, Glenn, we missed that. I do apologize. Do eclipses occur commonly on the Earth?
Reasonably commonly, yeah, quite a bit. I've got a book here. I think you can see if it's still available from NASA. Let me give you the name of it. It's called 5 Millennium Canon of Solar Eclipses. I'm not too sure how you define canons, like a list catalog type of thing. So
it's kind of a handbook that says this is the rules.
Mm-hmm. It goes from the year about 2000 BCE to 3000 CE, current era, before current era. And it's got a nice, let's see, how many pages? 1, 2, 3, 4, like 20 eclipses on a page. And how many pages do we have in this book? About 600 pages. So do the math. 20 eclipses per page. 600 pages in a 5,000 year span. And do the math, average it out, and it'll tell you how often there is an eclipse of the sun on the Earth. Now, they're not all total eclipses. There's some partial eclipses, and there's some annual eclipses too. Yes, so and total eclipses. The difference is the orbit of the moon being sometimes farther away from us and sometimes closer to us. When the moon goes in front of the sun and the moon is closer to us, then we have a total eclipse, but when the moon is farthest in its orbit and we have an eclipse that goes in front of the sun, then we have an annular eclipse, which means the moon doesn't completely cover up the sun. It leaves a ring of sunlight all the way around the moon. And partial means, maybe the total part was actually off the Earth, but we're actually able to see part of the moon shadow on the Earth. So there are quite a few eclipses. Let me give you like a rundown. Let's see, from now, I'll give you a quick list. Let me get to the right page here of upcoming eclipses. I'll just read them off very quickly. Let's see, here we are, August 21st, 2017. So we have one February 15th, 2018, July 13th, 2018, August 11th, 2018, January 6, 2019, July 2nd, 2019, December 26, 2019, in June of 2020, December of 2020, June of 2021, December of 2021, April of 2022, October 2022, April 2023, and October 2023. So that's basically, and it gives you a rundown. Sometimes there can be three eclipses in 1 year, sometimes none at all, sometimes just one. And I say sometimes they're just barely on the Earth. Sometimes they go across the North Pole, sometimes across the South Pole. And sometimes they're just partial in those regions, too. So basically all over. I would get, if you're really interested in when eclipses are, see if this book is still available from NASA.
So anyway, the other question was from Optronics.
Okay.
About an experiment where the ISS trailed a wire from the station. Now, I believe that was a power generation experiment.
I think so, too.
Using the magnetic field of the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
As I remember,
or just picking up charged particles around the Earth, maybe.
Just trying to see. As I remember, and I could be wrong on this. Basically, what they were doing, they were trying to see if they could generate a power field from the Earth's magnetic field.
Okay.
So as the ISS moves around, of course, it's going through the magnetosphere, is through the magnetic fields, and wires will pick up in certain circumstances a power charge.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what it was about. But I know that I think they dumped the cable very, very quickly because I think there was actually an issue where it could actually compromise the space station's power systems.
Mm. Well, you can look it up.
Yeah.
Yep. And it's, get it's more detail on that.
I know it happened, and I know it was kind of terminated very, very quickly because things were getting a little bit out of hand, and they were concerned that it could actually compromise the power system on the station, which would not have been good.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine that some solar activity would also charge up a line like that, too.
Oh, absolutely. So, this week's Sky at a Glance. Thank you, Sky and Telescope. So, as dawn begins to break on Saturday morning the 19th, look for a waning moon hanging under Venus low in the east. You can find Pollux and Castor, much fainter to Venus left or upper left. August is prime Milky Way time.
It is.
And, of course, the dark night is now moonless, so after dark, the Milky Way runs from Sagittarius in the south up and left across Aquila, and through the Big Summer Triangle very high in the east, and down through Cassiopeia to Perseus, rising low in the north-northeast. Sunday, with the moon out of the night sky, getting ready for tomorrow's command performance, obviously, at the eclipse, this is the time to be looking far away from the sun into the Cygnus Milky Way. High overhead, hunt out the telescopic deep sky sights, and they actually recommend that you go to Sue French's highlights in the August Sky and Telescope, page 54, for finder charts, photos, and eyepiece sketches. Monday the 21st, it's eclipse day. And guess what? I'm working. I will probably sneak onto the internet to watch it. But I'm all eclipsed out. I've heard so many people talking about here and on Facebook that I'm about ready to gag.
So you've heard enough, so you don't need to see it.
Exactly. After dusk, August nears its end. The great square of Pegasus looms up in the east, balancing on one corner. Its stars are only second and third magnitude, extending leftwards from the square's left corner is the main line of the constellation Andromeda, made of stars from about the same brightness. I don't agree with this. George Lovie, the late Sky and Telescope columnist, dubbed the whole pattern as Andromeda-Megasus Dipper. It's shaped like a giant Little Dipper, and it currently scoops up. I don't agree with that. You shouldn't start making your own constellations. So, Ursa Minor, meanwhile, is tipping over leftwards in the north. It's only about 40% as long as the Andromeda-Megasus Dipper. Horrible name. And it's much fainter. As always, it's rotated about 90 degrees counterclockwise from Andromeda Pegasus. I'm going to keep it that way. So, Thursday, after causing so much fuss on Monday, the moon now gleams shyly low in the west after sunset. Almost a fitzwith to its north is Jupiter, and fainter Spiker is further left or lower left. Friday, there should be another event horizon, so look low in the west in twilight for the waxing crescent moon. It forms a triangle with Jupiter and Spiker below it. I'll put the link in the room in a minute. And, of course, we'll cover Saturday the 26th on Friday the 25th. Ba-dum-bum-bum. Hello, Marty. Are you still with us?
Yep, I'm still here. Sorry.
Okay.
I muted when I sneezed.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. For those of you that will be in the path of totality, you will also be able to see some planets and stars in the sky. So to the east of the sun, will be rather close in, will be the planet Mars. Now, it's going to be kind of dim and reddish, so you're going to have to do a little bit of hunting for it. It's not a very bright planet. But way farther to the east will be the planet Venus. South of Venus will be Procyon, and south of that, Sirius. Above Venus is Pollux and Castor in Gemini. You might be able to pick those up. To the east of the sun, well, actually pretty close to it, within maybe two solar diameters will be the star Regulus. Again, that's going to be a little tricky, but you might be able to pick that one up. It's moderately bright. Going farther east, we got the planet Mercury. That's generally not too hard to see. And then way to the east is the planet Jupiter, and it's going to be really bright. To the lower, to the southeast of Jupiter, rather close to it, is the star Spica. So lots of planets and a few stars to look at during the eclipse. The main ones will be way to the east is Jupiter, way to the west is Venus. Those will be the most prominent ones you see. So try to get a quick glimpse of those planets during that short couple of minutes of totality.
And, of course, Regulus, you're saying about the total eclipse sun, Regulus will probably be in the actual halo of the eclipse sun at that point.
Possibly. It doesn't quite show it that. It looks like it's about two diameters, so it puts it about a degree away from the sun. So challenge to see if you can see the Regulus. Yeah, it might be a little bit in the corona.
Yeah, I'm looking at the star map on a Sky and Telescope link that I put in chat, and it's showing, looking south, southwest, high in the sky, and it shows Regulus in the corona.
I wonder if it will be relativistically shifted in position.
That would be interesting. So there you go. There is a challenge. If you are actually in the totality path, does Regulus appear in the corona, or has it been gravitationally lensed to a slightly different position?
Exactly. Now, the way to tell that is if you could take a picture and get more than just Regulus there, but if you can get a few other stars a little farther away, and then go back well after the eclipse, like a month or two, and take a picture of Regulus again and see if you can pick up those same stars, and if you can overlap those images and get all the stars to line up, but maybe not Regulus to quite line up. That might, I don't know how much it would actually shift relativistically if you could actually tell with amateur equipment like that, or you have to use some fairly high accurate scientific equipment. But it'd be interesting to see if an amateur could pick up a shift in position by being close to the sun's gravity. Mm. It's light coming through the sun's gravity.
Yeah,
to see if you could actually notice a shift in position with it. So that'd be definitely something to try.
I think if someone actually succeeds in doing that, Marty, that is going to be instant immortality. If you've actually managed to observe and prove that you saw Regulus gravitationally lensed by the sun during the solar eclipse.
What it will be is it'll be slightly out of position. That's what it will be. You won't see it you won't see it closer, bigger, anything like that. So it's just going to be shifted in position. Now, did they do that like 100 years ago to just to prove Einstein's theory of relativity. So I wonder what kind of equipment they use. And we only got a couple minutes to make some observations, and if they just did, had equipment set up already pointing at Regulus and then measured its position, if they're able to measure the positions of some stars nearby within that same couple of minutes or not, and accurately determine that it had shifted, that'd be kind of interesting to see.
I think this is something you would need to have equipment at two different locations, taking images and observations at the same time. See, this is the crux of this type of observation. You need two astronomers in contact with each other, and you need to be making observations and, more importantly, recording optically the observation. And that way you can actually see if there is a gravitational lensing effect.
I don't know if they did it optically or if they just did it, photographically. They might have just done it optically, just measured the position of the star closest to the sun and a couple others nearby, measured their separation as accurately as they could, as quick as he could, and that would allow them to determine that, that one of them was out of position.
Now, Black Projects has told us there was an old BBC TV show called Einstein's Universe that actually showed stars shifted due to a solar eclipse. So it is possible to do.
And I wonder,
given the equipment that modern astronomers have, I honestly believe it is. I think it is doable.
Be interesting to see. I wonder how much it shifted and how close they had to be to the sun in order to detect that too. So
and maybe it was link in the chat room to that show as well. Okay.
Might have been stars that were, just several arc minutes from the edge of the sun, as opposed to being a degree away from the sun. So obviously, the closer you are, the more shift you'll have. But wonder how it was. So I'll have to look that one up.
In fact, Astro One has said that he believes Eddington did that himself. Mm-hmm. Did that. So, and of course, there was a team, according to Optronics, just before World War One, that were trying to do that. They were captured as spies by Ottoman troops. So,
okay. It
is doable. And let's face it, as amateur astronomers today, we have some excellent optical equipment. We have some wicked camera equipment. We have cutting edge tools. Our tools are just as good as the professionals have. So I reckon it can be done.
I don't think we really need to go over too much eclipse stuff. Obviously, we've been going through for the whole week and stuff like that. We'll obviously have results next week after the eclipse and stuff like that too. I only had a couple ideas for suggestions. If you're going, charge your batteries now in your equipment, just to make sure that, don't wait till the last minute and try to charge them. If you're using a camera, go ahead and get another memory card for it. The one that's in there, if it's got pictures that you already want, leave it home so that you don't actually lose it on your trip, and put a fresh card in there. Nothing like, I've done this before, actually. You go taking a couple of astronomy pictures and all of a sudden you've run out of memory. I've had that at nighttime shooting the Milky Way. I only got like 3 pictures and the memory card was full. It's like, what? No way. So get yourself a fresh memory card for your camera.
Marty, we're getting close to beam out, mate.
Only a couple minutes,
just to quickly say that David Tennant was Arthur Eddington in the show, and that particular BBC show had Spring 1894 for the Carrington event. So there is a discrepancy. We need to hit the textbooks.
For those listening in, we're going to stop 5 minutes early because we got some extra programming that's going to last a little bit longer right after the Event Horizon here. So we'll start wrapping it up now. Well, thank everybody for listening in.
USS Miranda, Captain Savitt, 3 to beam up. Science party ready to come home.
Getting to be about that time. I'm not wearing a red shirt. And I want to thank everybody that's been in our chat room tonight. Really appreciate you being here. And like I said, we'll be back next week. I'm going to go down and see it. So see what happens. Be safe out there. Be safe driving, especially. Be safe with your eyes. Make sure you got your solar glasses. Just don't even catch a glimpse with it. Proper equipment everything like that for this. So hopefully everybody will get a good chance to see it. Hopefully the weather will cooperate and the roads will cooperate and everything else like that.
Good night.
All right, everybody. Appreciate it. And see you all again next week. Good night.
Good night.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of Astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website. It's really easy to find us. We are Astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the Voice of Astronomy. Around the world and across the known universe, this is Astronomy.fm Radio.
Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM. There I was, doing my thing. And all of a sudden, wham! Astronomy right between the eyes.